Greetings, fellow Portlanders. From the Emerson News Network, this is Legion of News.
High atop the mill packing district in the hearts of beautiful southeast Portland, Oregon. This, my friends, is Legion of News.
What?
Yes. Oh. A 1 hour distillation of all important knowledge from everywhere. My name is Big Jim Willig alongside the always lovely Don Taylor, who is, even as I speak, these mouth sounds to your ear holes. Preparing information on a vast swath of happenings, including, but not limited to, the following.
A woman dies after driving into the Willamette River. U.S. stocks drop more than 390 points.
That's bad.
And a woman is arrested after shooting a possum.
Like you do. As always, my friends, have no doubt that this conglomeration of factual discourse and ideological screed will render you shocked, amazed, enraptured, and demonstrably more intelligent than when you began this hour. And now, without further ado, pay heed, for this is Legion of News.
I know you're trying to sound all stately and everything. It really just sounds like you're trying to scare everyone. Stay away from the old Johnson place.
You're all doomed. I just want everyone to feel as, I wouldn't say scared, more apprehensive as I am right now. So
you're sitting across from a woman who's like scratching her armpit.
Yeah.
So, you know, come on.
Just Daddy likey.
Not a lot to be worried about. Good afternoon. I'm Don Taylor.
Good afternoon.
This is, of course, whoa. Did I just pull out my own headphones? Hold on.
Did you?
Oh, there we go.
All right.
This is absolutely everything you need to know, by the way, for Friday, September 23rd, 2011. Tickety tick. A woman died early Friday morning, that would be this morning, after she drove through Salmon Street Springs, through the seawall, and into the Willamette River. Portland Fire Bureau divers found her body in the Toyota Camry she was driving. She was thought to be alone. Crash and forensics teams were investigating the 2:45 a.m. accident, and city crews were shoring up the seawall. I wonder if alcohol was involved.
No. She's an aquatic enthusiast.
2:45 a.m. The car just missed the bow of the Portland Spirit cruise ship. Damn it. How awesome would it have been if it just gone over the seawall and onto the deck of the ship?
I think you need a Bruce Willis to be able to pull off a maneuver such as that.
Divers entered the water around 3 a.m. and the woman's body was brought up about 3:30. Oh, yeah, this is a sad story. She could not be revived. Her identity has not been released, but she's thought to be in her 30s or 40s. And I'm imagining just filled to the brim with booze.
Yeah, that commercial for driving while intoxicated, where they basically filled a car filled with beer, or there's one that has wine in it, and then there's another one that has olives and I'm assuming a martini of some sort, and like the entire cab of the car is just sloshing.
I haven't seen that.
You haven't?
No.
Oh my, yeah. And so they pull it over.
I don't watch a lot of actual television anymore. I watch everything back computer, so.
Well, you know, there's a part where the cop opens the door and, like, this tidal wave of booze just comes pouring out. And the guy's looking at her like, what? It's how I go to church. Mother Cabrini, you don't touch the stuff? You judge me?
I was actually driving to work this morning, driving into the studio here, and I was in the process of thinking to myself, damn it, I wish Walgreens would fill my Vicodin. I miss my Vicodin. When I looked up and there was a Serenity Lane billboard, which I had a moment of, oh, is someone trying to tell me something? But it has this kid, this big doe-eyed child on it. And I swear to God, and if you're not from the Portland area, Serenity Lane is a drug and
it's
alcohol
a Betty Ford
treatment clinic here, treatment facility here in the Portland metro-ish area. Anyway, so it's this big doe-eyed, sad-looking, adorable tot. And it says on the billboard, getting him off the bottle was easy. Now it's daddy's turn.
And maybe if you cried a little less, daddy wouldn't need to turn to that bottle quite so often, now, like, would he?
Wow, is that really going to help? Is that really going to shame someone on their morning commute going, oh, they're right. My little Jimmy at home will feel bad. Wow. Getting him off the bottle was easy. Now it is my turn.
You know what?
Thank you, Surrender. Thank you, Billboard.
No, guys, let's turn this bus around. Let's head back to work. That Kinko's needs a sharp and prepped and ready to go.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. Moving along.
If you have any Vicodin, though, I would be more than happy to share some. Unsuccessful in your Vicodin.
I'm still waiting. My doctor's office is they're not like Johnny on the spot with responding to those faxes from Walgreens about, like, this person would really like their life-saving medication.
Excruciating pain.
And
stop.
Then, and then if you call them and say, hey, how come you haven't, like, approved my refill? And they go, well, you know, we tell everyone it can take between 3 and 5 days. I'm like, it's a fax. It's a fax that comes to you, and you pick up the phone and you go, yeah, okay.
No,
it's not that hard.
It's actually, the gentleman's name is Gary Fax. He runs a rickshaw company, and he's the one that actually ferries the paperwork from your doctor's office to the pharmacy.
Also, I know for a fact, every time I call you and complain that it's taken too long, within 3 hours, it's done. So I know that it's not because you have some kind of bureaucracy you have to go through. And you're just not looking at the pile of papers by the fax machine.
Yeah, you know, and if you're in blinding pain, I don't think you're going to want to wait 3 to 5 business days in order for them to get their act together.
Well, sir, if it's, it is a refill on a prescription, and you should realize that it can take 3 days, so you should be ordering them ahead of time.
Oh, okay. Well, why don't you just give me all the prescriptions, all 6 of these refills, all at once? Give me like a big, like 55 gallon.
Oh, no, we can't do that. See, if we have to wait 30 days before we can give it to you.
Well, maybe if you anticipated my drug needs ahead of time.
Do you realize that I am a drug addicted pain person?
I'm a Pfizer monkey.
Give my delicious, delicious Vicodin. Did you not realize that the lock screen on my iPhone was just a picture of a Vicodin that I found online and I downloaded and I used it as wallpaper? So come on. All right.
Bastards.
All right. But the thing is, I'm all dried out now, so how much better is it going to feel when I finally get them?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Once the effects have thoroughly left the body,
yeah.
it's like discovering an old friend for the first time.
It is. Yeah. It's going to be a good weekend.
Yeah, January 1st, I am anticipating with great fervor.
For those of you who are privy to the workings of the studio, and I don't even know why he was asking, but before the show, Jim said, so, you ever taken Quaaludes? And I said, actually, no. I have taken many kinds of drugs in my life, but I've never taken Quaaludes. I just wonder what it feels like. Just wonder. I'm like, why? He goes, just curious. Just intellectual exercise. No.
Well, tobacco has been around for hundreds of years. Same with various other drugs. Alcohol, obviously, has been around for a good long time. There have been attempts to outlaw them, to sort of put them off the books, but they've always managed to find a way through. Quaaludes, for some mysterious reason, celebrated this great, like, these salad days that everybody that it was anybody was dropping them, but then they just kind of fell off the face of the earth, and now you don't have a Quaalude guy anymore. He's out of a job. I've always wondered, what the sensation.
They're like the Thin Lizzy of drugs.
Exactly. You know, I want to know.
We all loved them once and remember them fondly, and yet where are they now?
So there's going to be like a country fair somewhere where I can get me a deep-fried elephant ear with a Quaalude crust all around the edges.
You know, in 1972, it was the sixth largest selling sedative in the United States.
There was, I love the
and
fact that there was.
That's legal use.
I love the fact that there were six others on that list. I mean, it's, was that just.
Well, this thing we talked about earlier, and you'd asked, and I'm right. I was looking this up just to make sure I was correct, because as we know from listening to the show, I'm not always right in the things I say. That it was prescribed as a sedative, but instead of like the current sedatives that we normally use now, which are usually nervous system depressants.
Mm-hmm.
Quaaludes were a hypnotic, and it was prescribed as for insomnia and as a muscle relaxant. And they're like psychoactive drugs that actually just like mess with your brain chemistry.
Cool.
And then make you go, woo, and then you fall over. So I guess that was that. I don't know. I don't know why. I guess maybe they decided that perhaps it wasn't a good idea, particularly since if you take too many of them, you like have the Quaalude equivalent of an alcoholic blackout. So I guess somebody decided that might not be such a good idea.
Well, I mean, everything obviously has to be taken in moderation. But if I don't know, if I can't get a good accurate, because I know what most of the other buzzes feel like. Mm-hmm. I know what. You know, everything from caffeine to, like, you know, some barbiturates and everything else, they kind of feel like. I've just always wondered, because most people that have ever done Quaaludes talk about them with the fondness of someone that's like, you know, I experienced something that will never be experienced again.
Well, according to Wikipedia, effects can include euphoria, drowsiness, reduced heart rate, reduced respiration.
Reduced heart rate. Increased two arteries.
Increased sexual arousal and numbness of the fingers and toes.
Baby, I'd love to have sex with you right now, but my hands, I can't grip. What is this? What am I feeling right here? What is that?
You have never been so good, except for maybe the floppy thalidomide baby hands. What the hell is with that?
Do you feel like I do?
Is this a new thing? Because I'm not really feeling it.
Do you feel like I do? I can't feel anything. Tell me you feel like I do.
Okay, back to the news.
That's been Quaalude Talk. With Don and Jim.
Da, 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 da. What began as a rough day for Wall Street yesterday didn't get much better in the afternoon as U.S. stocks tumbled after international markets, as investors continued to fret about the American and European economies.
Hmm.
After dropping more than 340 points before noon, the Dow Jones average closed the day's trading down roughly 390 points, or roughly 3.5%. The NASDAQ fell 82.52 points, or 3.25%. And the S&P 500 dropped about 3.19%. Bloomberg, who tracks such things, they explained that the Federal Reserve said yesterday it saw significant downside risks in the economy, and it will replace $400 billion in short-term debt with longer-term treasuries to spur growth as the recovery falters. China's manufacturing may shrink for the third month in September, while U.S. jobless claims topped estimates, and FedEx slid the most in more than 2 years after cutting its profit forecast. So all of those combined for some kind of perfect storm of stock market crash.
A foobar. I was going to say, the U.S. mail obviously has been hit the hardest, what with the onset of the computer age continuing to just sort of dominate all major media outlets and then information transfer. I know FedEx is doing the best that they can to kind of preemptively keep what little business they have afloat by they're reintroducing reusable like envelopes and various other transport stuff as well. So yeah, it's obvious that, you know, the computers, as nice as they are, they keep getting smaller and more inexpensive, are just kind of devouring everything in their sway, and then ultimately. I feel like I'm some kind of conspiracy theorist in my thoughts that when all of
that
these,
it's the Jews,
yeah, clearly, yes, but no, it's
the Jews and aliens are behind this.
Alien Jews. You said it, Don Taylor. Alien Jews.
Somebody had to say it out loud. We've all been tiptoeing around it for far too long.
Space goyims are gonna come from the sky. They're gonna take everything you work so hard for. But once the shiny goes away, you know, and it seems like the more interest and the more importance that we put on this, the more delicate that connection is. And if it's severed, great vast chunks of the population are just going to be lost outright. They're not going to know what to do or really how to kind of interact because...
Well, that, honestly, if you start chipping away at the postal system, that does affect lower-income people more than anyone else.
Yeah.
Because, you know, there are people who, you know, don't send things FedEx, who don't use email for everything, who don't have fax machines. They actually do. They don't get online. And, you know, older people as well. They don't get online and send, you know, e-cards. They actually still buy greeting cards at Hallmark and put a stamp on it and put it in the mail. Yeah. They still mail their, they pay their bills by check and put them in the mail. And so those are the people that are going to be the hardest hit. But if we take away the amazingly democratic system that we have.
Of course.
Of cheap, you know, delivery of things from any person to any other person. And then also, as somebody pointed out, actually, I was getting my massage this morning because
getting your rub
I
on.
Am that person. I'm talking about the plight of the poor people and then saying, well, my massage therapist was telling you this morning. But no, but he made...
my poor little massage therapist was just... I said, desperately.
Oh, you make an excellent point, Dexter.
Don't look me in the eye.
But he did mention this point. Like, he said that... and I forgot what he was saying now, too. But the thing is, like, if we end up, like, that we are the biggest, like, first world country in the world that, like, doesn't have a postal system, how humiliating is that going to be?
Yeah.
I mean, what is that saying about, like, our class system, which we'd like to pretend we don't have?
Yeah, because we're all pretty much, and this is where every time I think or talk like this, I feel like I should have an aluminum foil yarmulke on. But... we're just one EMP away from getting all that just wiped away. And unless you have it on some kind of more permanent medium, you're screwed. Or if you've kind of like grown up in a world where you've only ever known text messages or leet speak or, you know, typing, you don't know how... I don't write in cursive anymore. I print everything. And, like, the more I try and think about it, the more, like, that part of my brain is just kind of, like, evaporated or has been kind of pushed out so that some other useless factual information, probably something to do with Windows Excel or something like that, that's kind of, like, co-opted that space in my brain now.
Okay, then.
Yeah.
Back to the stock market.
I don't need a point, Dawn. I just talk to hear myself speak.
Well... you wouldn't be the only person who ever sat in that chair and did that, let me just say. Senior political analyst for CNN, David Gergen, says that the confidence in the stock markets, you remember the stock markets, we were talking about that. About
oh, that's where the rich people hang out.
Is mirroring confidence in the U.S. Congress. And
they're all thinking about 2012, and there's a real sense in the country, can't you guys spend 3 to 6 months helping to fix the economy in serious ways, like tax reform, and get off the trail for a while?
That also, by the way, is my mistake. I apparently turned up TweetDeck. Don't put on the TweetDeck, because then every time someone tweets, it makes that noise.
Tweet.
Yay, playing things off my computer, and I'm an idiot. All right, so that happened.
Do you have any stocks? Or
God, no.
Yeah.
God, no. I don't even have any money. I have nothing. My retirement plan is basically to live in a cardboard box under a freeway overpass at this point.
Luxury.
So, yes. And the freeway, yes. And I plan to battle to the death for that cardboard box.
Yeah.
Because I know that they are going to be a hot commodity by the time I get around to retiring.
My plan is to sublet a cardboard box, probably with me and a couple other college buddies. We're going to go in. Maybe get ourselves like a nice dishwasher box or something.
Well, I have a group of friends that I've known for about 20 years, and we have a Yahoo Mail group that we started like 10, 12 years ago, even more than that. And so we always are like sort of in daily contact with each other via email to the group, which is awesome because some of them live in San Francisco, some of them live in LA, I live here in Portland, but we're still always in constant, like kind of a constant conversation going on amongst us. And it's a fairly common theme that's been going on for the last 10 years of, you know, every couple of months somebody going, and we are all going to move in together when we're old so that we don't starve to death and die, right? We are just getting like one big house and then maybe hiring a cabana boy to help dress us, right? Because I have no money. Yes, that's our plan. That is our big plan. So.
You're basically going to take the page out of the Golden Girls book.
It's going to be like a fivesome Golden Girls, really.
Do you have a dibs on whether you're going to be like a B. Arthur or Betty White?
I would like to be the Betty White, but I fear that...
You're too smart for Betty White.
Well, my mother, you have to remember, my mother was... my mother looked like sort of, when she got older, she looked like a cross between Betty White and Anne B. Davis.
Yeah.
But she talked and acted like Bea Arthur.
Ah.
So I've always thought that, you know, I've always feared that that would be my thing, except I don't smoke anymore. I didn't. She started smoking as a teenager and kept smoking up until she died. I only smoked for maybe like off and on for about 10 years. So I don't have that like deep voice thing going on. So I'm not going to be like that. So that's fine. But I don't know. I'd like to be the Betty White, but I am a little bit smarter than that. So I'm really not. Sadly, I think I will probably be more like Sophia.
So you're the sarcastic one?
Yeah, I'll just be the one who's just mean.
Yeah.
I'll just be mean to everyone, and they'll hate me. That will basically be it. They'll leave me at the mall and hope that I can't find my way home.
We left her at Forever 21. She's senile now.
In other news, Powell's Books announced the layoffs of 8 managers on Thursday. The layoffs are a reorganization of its corporate management structure as part of a continued effort by the company to respond to the rapidly changing book industry, said an email from CEO Ann Smith. In other words, we're not making as much money because people aren't buying as many books. The announcement notes that readers' consumer behavior, how, where, and what people read, has changed dramatically at an unprecedented rate with smartphones and mobile devices like Kindle and iPad. With the planned retirement of Smith as CEO, Emily Powell, daughter of the store's founder, Michael Powell, will become president and CEO. She said, "This is a difficult and painful time for Powell's. The managers who were laid off today will be greatly missed." Powell had announced previous layoffs and cost-cutting measures in February. They have operated as an independent bookseller since 1971 with 4 general bookstores and 1 specialty store. The flagship store occupies an entire city block. Excuse me. In all, Powell's has a total inventory of roughly 4 million new, used, and rare books.
That's disheartening to hear.
I mean, it is.
And I've never gone past Powell's where they haven't just been packed to the rafters. You know what they need to get rid of? Is their little coffee shop area where you can just sort of like kick
less
back.
Less hipsters.
Yeah. Less hipsters, more ka-ching in the cash register.
Yeah, maybe the just letting people hang around all the day and read for free is not really working. Although
charge by chapter. You know?
It's hard for me to imagine that Powell's, my thing is rather than fire people, well, you'd have to fire people, but rather than just like sort of thin out your existing stores, get rid of a couple of the existing stores.
Yeah.
Keep the big store. The big store is, at this point, a Powell's landmark. People come from around the world to visit Portland, and their first stop is Powell's City of Books.
Yeah.
And so, you know, maintain that. It's like, yeah, don't, I don't know. But then again, look at me. Who am I to give business advice? I'm doing this. So I'll just shut up now because I don't know anything.
Well, and I'm kind of torn on this in that I do love Kindles. I think it's a great idea and a great use of technology. But at the same time, there's something very familiar, very comforting about walking into the smell of books, the feel of like carrying a book around with you. And it's going to sound cheap.
You are so old. Books.
Sitting in a park bench somewhere. Nice sunny day. Not too hot, not too cold. Maybe take a nice little cardigan with me and some bread for the geese and the goslings. You know, and I just sit and I read and I spit at the young people. But Kindles are, they're just remarkable. And they're so light. I like the fact that they don't give you that same eye strain as like a laptop or like a computer screen gives you for any long period of time. So
they have their place, but I honestly feel like they ought to be a...
They should be able to coexist.
They should be a supplement to books, not a replacement for books.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Okay.
All right.
I'm going to do the science news now.
We're going to move along.
Do you want to pimp Squire's Electric or shall I?
If you would, please.
Well, it is now time for Science on the March, brought to you by the fine folks at Squires Electric. They're a full-service electrical contractor for all your residential and commercial needs. If you ever find yourself with wires, wiring, anything to do with wires or wiring, anything electrical, anything that buzzes or clicks or might electrocute you and kill you, rather than fiddle with it yourself, you should call the people at Squires Electric. You can reach them at 503-252-1609. You can also find them online at squireselectric.com or visit them on Facebook. Look for Squires Electric. And they are a fine sponsor of this program, Legion of News, and a sponsor of Science on the March.
Yes.
The headlights on a... okay. I started to read this yesterday, and I tossed it aside, and I ended up not throwing it away. I'm getting rid of it now. I don't want to read that story. Let's start again. Science on the March.
Science.
Many people believe in ghosts and heaven.
I believe in
Jim
ghosts.
Willick.
I believe in ghosts.
Oh, good. So do I.
Nah, heaven I really kind of quantify as... Yeah.
This isn't about you. This is about science.
I'm part of science. All right. We're all part of science.
Well, about 3 in 100 Americans report actually having near-death experiences. These typically include an awareness of being dead, out-of-body experiences, meeting dead people, entering tunnels of light, and so on. But what does science have to say about this?
You're stupid.
Pretty much, yeah. A new article published in Trends in Cognitive Sciences by neuroscientist Dean Mobbs of the University of Cambridge's Medical Research Council Cognition and Brain Sciences Unit and Carolyn Watt of the University of Edinburgh finds that contrary to popular belief, research suggests there is nothing paranormal about these experiences. Instead, near-death experiences are the manifestation of normal brain function gone awry during a traumatic and sometimes harmless event. Mobbs and Wyatt noted that many classic near-death experience symptoms are actually reported by people who were never in danger of dying in the first place. This suggests the perception that one is near death is traumatic and disturbing enough to cause some of the experiences. A researcher who wrote a book called Dying to Live, Near-Death Experiences, Susan Blackmore, notes that many NDEs, as we call them, such as euphoria and the feeling of moving toward a tunnel of white light, are common symptoms of oxygen deprivation in the brain.
Yeah.
The new paper also discusses something called walking corpse syndrome, named after French neurologist Jules Cotard, who I guess was also known as Jules the Corpse.
Yeah.
Because they're naming it after him, and it's called walking corpse syndrome.
Yeah, anyone that's been to a Fish concert has pretty much seen the same thing.
The sufferer feels that he or she is dead, even though not actually near death. It can be associated with trauma and some illnesses. It's not fully understood why individuals suffer from Cotard syndrome, but one possibility is that the brain's attempt to make sense of the strange experiences that the patient is having. So the research suggests also that people who have returned from the dead, they're saying they returned from clinical brain death.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently no one has ever survived true clinical death, which is why the experiences are called near-death experiences. Many people have been revived after their heart stopped for short periods of time, around 20 minutes or more, but anyone revived from brain death would be permanently and irreparably brain damaged and unable to report their experiences.
See also Nikki Six from Motley Crue. No, I read something similar in Tobin's Spirit Guide in regards to...
near-death experiences.
Yeah, where, you know, the whole tunnel thing and the line of vision, basically the light being that your vision is kind of being reduced down to a singularity. And that light at the end of the tunnel is just the last of your vision being able to transfer, like the last cone, sort of being able to make the reflection of light through the lens of the eye and everything else like that. So I've come close to drowning once.
Really?
As a young lad, there was a rope swing involved. There's a train tracks that went above a river in Susquehanna area, Pennsylvania, and in the summertime, someone would go on the train tracks and drop in a very, very long length of rope that they would tie to the top. And people would subsequently swing out over this little river and then, do what white trash do, which is, you know, basically drink and fish and enjoy the land. As the Native Americans would say, take only pictures, leave only beer caps. And what happened was I swung out, and then on the return swing, I smacked into the wall that is supporting the train tracks from up above and started to lose my grip. And there was like this small little like a tide pool or some kind of...
an abyss?
Kind of, yeah. Something where it's like not quite like a whirlpool, but an area that sucked water down a specific area, and I landed square in that. And it was very much almost like a movie where I could see everybody on land trying to yell to me because I was just below the water's level. So everything was kind of like fishy, and they're trying to yell. They were yelling something to me. What they were yelling was, stop fighting the current, let it sort of suck you down and spit you
go
out.
Go toward the light.
Pretty much,
go toward the light.
And eventually, I didn't so much do what they had said. I just kind of ran out of strength and let the tide kind of take me and spit me out. And at that point, I kind of had that feeling of, is this the end for our, you know, our hero? And got spit up about 40 yards down the stream and came up and was able to swim to shore. And my friend, who, like, one of my best friends at the time, who was there with me, his level of concern was masked only by his crippling laughter that he was fallen on his ass. Like, you almost died.
Oh, friends.
That's hilarious. So I think he has crabs. Yeah. No, that's okay. Fine.
I actually totaled a car once. I had a big old early 1970s truck that I had driven here to from California when I moved here. And I knew I needed new brakes, but I just kept putting it off. And it was one of those things of like, okay, I'm going to do this last thing. I'm going to drive to my company picnic and have several beers and come home. And then
on my bad
tomorrow,
brakes.
Tomorrow I will take the car in and get the brakes. And when I was getting off the freeway, the beers actually, ironically, had nothing to do with any of this. I was getting off the freeway and going about 50 miles an hour, and I hit the brakes, and the thing where you hit the brake pedal, and it just keeps going.
Oh, no.
And you have no brakes. And I did the whole thing of, like, turning off the engine and trying to throw it into park and doing all these things, and I'm just hurtling off of down this street. And I ended up, like, you know, just hanging a left when I got to the street because it was a T-intersection. Fortunately, there were no cars. I had like a big empty space and no cars were there. But I had that thing of like there were cars coming and I had to make that decision of like, am I going to smash into somebody or take it off the road? So I just yanked on the steering wheel and took it off the side of the road. And there was an embankment and I rolled it sideways down an embankment and it smacked into a tree. Otherwise, I would have ended up in the river. But the thing is, I had that experience that I've heard about when you watch movies and there's somebody's like car is going off a bridge or something, and in the film, they make everything go kind of in slow motion and that sort of thing. I was sort of tumbling around. I didn't have my seatbelt on either. I was tumbling around in the cab of this thing and realizing that I was probably going to die. And I had that experience that I understand it comes from the adrenaline like pumping into your brain, where it was all very calm.
Yeah.
And I had even though it was only a few seconds, there was that thing where I had enough time to just think, this is probably going to kill me.
Yeah.
And realize, wow, really now? Wow, that sucks. That was pretty much my whole thought.
Your like, last thoughts are figures.
Like, really? This is what does it? After everything I've been through? This? Yeah. And then I crashed, and it was over, and it's like, oh, hey, I'm not dead. I guess I better crawl out of my upside-down truck now before it bursts into flames. But, yeah, the brain is a very weird thing.
Yeah.
That in times, moments of extreme stress, you know, and adrenaline and stuff, it does very weird things.
And it's funny how those moments kind of are embedded in your mind with vivid clarity. Like, I can remember everything about that swing set and then a few other moments in my life where, without really realizing it at that very moment, just how near to the end it could have been. But part of me kind of knew. And you're right, there is that sense of calmingness where, you know, which I've always taken away as a good thing, because that means that I don't have any regrets that, you know, should like Skylab fall out of the sky and because there's supposed to be a satellite that's if it were to fall and crush us both at this moment, I'd be cool with it, because I've done a lot of the stuff that I've wanted to. If I go out now, I haven't screwed things up too irreparably, and I go out in the plus column as opposed to the minus column. Mm-hmm. You know, if one of those moments happened and I had that sense of like immediacy and terror because of the fact that there are so many things left undone, I think that's a much more horrifying way to go.
Yes. Wow, this went in a dark, dark direction, didn't
science
it?
Isn't always pretty, Dawn.
Okay, one more science story.
then a hug.
IBM's Watson computer has made a major breakthrough in human speech and is about to use it to help solve real-world problems. We finally reached the point where we have this supercomputer that can consistently outsmart human beings, such as playing Jeopardy. Now, Watson is about to move from playing games to solving real-world problems. Its creators at IBM are assuring us that Watson is going to lead a big assist to humanity, is completely under human control, and doesn't pose any dangers to anyone.
That's what the computer wants you to believe.
On Wednesday, it was unveiled at a global innovation conference in Louisville, Kentucky. The computer took on two teams of local high school students in a game of Jeopardy, and of course, it won. IBM's David Shepler presaged the Jeopardy game with a 40-minute presentation about Watson to a crowd of entrepreneurs, thought leaders, and innovators. This was called Idea Festival, all one word, and said that Watson's days as a Jeopardy champion are numbered. It's time for him to start tackling real-world problems. He can understand language subtleties and implied meanings, make leaps needed to connect questions with the appropriate answers. They're going to use it in certain fields such as healthcare, life sciences, tech support, enterprise knowledge management, business intelligence, and government services. But, of course, the most well-publicized one is it's going to be involved with WellPoint, the HMO, where it's going to help doctors make decisions by processing data and quickly providing analyses. So, but I do like, though, that they did go out of their way, though. The IBM guy actually felt like he needed to tell all of these people ahead of time, Watson comes in peace. He only has the best interests of humanity in mind. You have nothing to fear from Watson.
Nothing to fear.
Yeah, I'm not so sure.
Well, here's the problem. Because we as biped carbon-based life forms haven't been able to figure out the solutions to our problems and have hence now created this iron giant to kind of step in to start solving these problems, they don't have all of the components of being, you know, human. They don't have, like, the emotions of, like, say, compassion or understanding. They only see ones and zeros. And that's where the whole robot holocaust kind of comes from, is they see the issue being us copper tops are fighting amongst ourselves. If they put us all in little pods and suckle all the electrical, bioelectrical energy that they can from us, thus keeping them alive, then world peace is achieved.
Yeah. Also,
and you're welcome.
Yeah. Yeah, once they realize that we are illogical and dangerous and violent, say, we do not need you anymore.
Exactly. And they come in peace. They mean us no harm. Not now, but no. Once you kind of let them free and give them their druthers, that's when the big Gatling guns come out. And you
combine this with, like, all that crap they're doing in Japan, making, like, the lifelike skin and the robots that, like, know how hard they could poke someone before they kill them. You know, and the ones that look like sex bots. I mean, it's just,
it's a hop, skip, and
it's
a jump.
Wrong.
And then next thing you know, we're being corralled by apes on horseback and shoved into pens.
And our government is all worried about whether or not they're going to fund Medicare.
Yeah.
How about we do something about the robot menace? For the love of God.
We don't have any money left for Medicare because it's all going towards our adamantium supply. Great. Well, so we got that to look forward to.
That's all the science.
Thank God for that. Jeez.
The scary, scary science. Okay.
Back to nice, just peaceful, regular news.
Right. Well, the owner, this is, I believe, a quintessential Portland, Oregon story. The owner of the kittens that were dumped out of a moving van has come forward to say it was all a terrible accident. Early this month, drivers picked up the kittens they saw coming out of a minivan near North Peninsula Avenue and Willis Boulevard. One kitten was badly hurt and had to be put down.
Oh, geez.
The other two went to the Oregon Humane Society. The owner told investigators, when they finally tracked him down, that the kittens had fallen asleep inside the wheel well. One kitten even rode all the way to Vancouver under the van. Investigators say his story checks out, and no charges have been filed.
How does the story check out? So was there a wicker basket up in the wheel well?
Originally, this story was reported that someone had thrown kittens from a van.
At the feet of a Native American who just turned
in traffic,
and cried.
Just threw kittens out of a van. So now we've discovered the kittens were not thrown out of the van. They had just fallen asleep.
They leapt of their own volition.
They had fallen asleep inside the wheel well and just tumbled from the van. And again,
that's better, question mark?
News in Portland, Oregon. This is being reported by our major news sources here in Portland, Oregon. Yes, the kittens were merely sleeping. They were not tossed out.
Let news. Sleeping kittens lie? I say no, friend.
I love this town. Seriously.
Oh, man.
Thank you, KGW and KPTV, who reported on this important story about kittens.
Have you seen they've kind of revamped the Sarah McLachlan guilt trip in the arms of an angel?
I will remember.
Yeah.
Meow.
But yeah. it's even worse now because like there was those which were just like out, just mean and evil because Sarah McLachlan's now guilt tripping me using her songs to make me feel like a horrible, you know, bastard for not buying a farm somewhere and just scooping up all the poor and unwanted and mistreated
Look
animals.
At the sad puppy
yeah,
face.
I don't have a Grammy, Sarah McLachlan. You do. Maybe you should buy the farm and have us come out and volunteer. And that seems like a more plausible usage of time
this
and energy.
This kitten will die without you, Big Jim Woman.
Yeah, really.
This kitten right here.
They're one step away from that.
I remember you.
But now, and then after that, they had some with David Duchovny, which were a little bit more...
Well, those are pedigree food ads, though. Those aren't like yeah. save the dying kittens. No, those are delightful because they're telling you about how, you know, you should like dogs and stuff, but it's actually selling you dog food.
But yeah, it at least, like, it didn't make me immediately want to turn the channel as soon as I saw an animal kind of being as, like, the feature. But now they've kind of come back and made it, like, meaner and more manipulative than ever because it's just, like, these shots of... like a cat that's got like some kind of weird eye fungus that is like swollen it shut. And the caption just reads, "Why do they hate me?"
Oh.
And then there's another one where there's a dog that looks emaciated and like it's about ready to fall over and just expire right there. And it says, "Will I ever get out of this cage?" And then, like, the voiceover comes in, and it's just like, these animals are missed. Like, every day, a gajillion animals are thrown in a meat compressors and, you know, and you just sit there in your house just loving life and you don't even care that these animals and they have like a horse that you can see its ribs. It's just, oh, it's terrible.
Oh, God.
So, yeah, it's we need to work together to get these animals sorted. And if anything, I think we should make these commercials where your money goes towards the chemical castration of said owners.
I want a warm belly to sleep on.
A big house.
How do I look? Do I look good?
I want to play hard.
My nails done. Once a month.
See, there are cats that are talking.
I want a home.
I just want a home. I want someone to love.
Last year, more than 30,000 companion animals came to us without homes. 20,000 of them were felines. Let's make some homes together.
You
like to play tennis, don't you? Tennis rackets. There's a solution. How about Chinese food?
I'm an adorable kitten, and I'm sad.
Why are you punching me in the face with your hate?
Please don't throw me from your minivan.
We could go on a trip together, and I don't have to ride in the wheel well.
So now, did you adopt a cat then?
No. I've always been more of a dog person than a cat person, just because of the simple fact that cats really don't care whether you're there or not.
No, not so much.
Dogs, on the other hand, you know, they celebrate your every moment.
I was waiting for my massage this morning, and I picked up a Reader's Digest, and it was like, our funniest cartoons from years past in the Reader's Digest. I'm like, okay, these aren't going to be funny. And yet, and this is pretty good for a Reader's Digest, there was this cartoon with these two cats talking, and the one cat is saying, you know, they declawed me, but they forgot I had this, and it's holding a switchblade. So, anyway. President Obama is getting a little strange bedfellow help on his plans to rebuild the nation's bridges from the unlikeliest sources, none other than Senator Rand Paul.
So he's
Kentucky.
Quite literally trying to build bridges at this point.
He is literally building bridges.
Wow.
Paul accompanied the president on Air Force One Tuesday to Cincinnati and attended Obama's jobs speech in front of the crumbling Brent Spence Bridge, which spans southern Ohio, conveniently close to Speaker John Boehner's district, and northern Kentucky, home to Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell. Both Boehner and McConnell have rejected the majority of the president's jobs plans. But Obama and Tea Party darling Paul seemed downright chummy on Tuesday. The president even gave him a shout-out during his opening remarks. Senator Rand Paul is here, Obama said, and the crowd responded with a resounding boo. The president then told the crowd it was okay. Rand is going to be supporting bridges. So don't boo his crazy ass. He's here for the bridges.
Bridge hater, get out of town if you could.
Rand Paul isn't really supporting the president's plan to rebuild the nation's infrastructure, although he would like to see several of the aging bridges in Kentucky renovated with federal funds. Instead, he has his own alternative proposal. He has said he wants to pay for the needed bridge repairs from an emergency bridge fund that would tap money previously set aside for projects that Paul has decided aren't necessary. So he's kind of thought, you know, I don't need your federal money. I'm just going to, like, screw some other people out of some things that we need done and fix the bridge with this other money.
But they have an actual, like, there's seriously, yeah, like, there's a chunk of cash that just says emergency money. Bridge fund
right.
in, like, a bread box somewhere in this in Iowa. And he's like, well, no, I don't need that because I just remembered I've got this, like, pumpernickel loaf of $1,000 bills that I could just
We had this food we were going to give some poor people, but I don't believe in that. Because I'm a crazy libertarian, so how about we fix the bridge with the food money instead of taking the bridge money from the government?
Or better yet, we take the money, we spend it on food, and then we use the food as supplies, so like we're filling holes with processed meat and corn.
So meanwhile, Mr. Obama was there to talk about his jobs thing, because again, this bridge goes between Mitch McConnell's, town. And John Boehner's town. And so he felt that was a good symbolic place to stand there and talk about his jobs plan that both of them are against. And so he is mentioning that he believes that they are wrong in calling this class warfare.
If asking a billionaire to pay their fair share of taxes, to pay the same tax rate as a plumber or a teacher, is class warfare, then you know what? I'm a warrior for the middle class.
Well, yeah. The president criticized Kentucky Senator Mitch McConnell's past statements that his number one priority was to get Obama out of the White House.
Not jobs. Not putting people back to work. Not rebuilding America. Beating me.
Yeah, okay. He was doing his folksy I'm just one of you people voice that I love so much. I don't know if you've noticed that we've been playing these sound clips of Obama for the last year and a half here on Legion of News, and he has like three different voices he uses depending on who he's talking to.
Mm-hmm.
There's his slow, I'm a statesman voice he uses when he's talking to Congress. Then there's his slightly more, like peppy, but still Ivy League educated, tone that he uses when he's talking about something really, really serious. And then whenever he's out, like, stumping and out on something where he's surrounded by regular people, then he's talking about how we're getting some new jobs. He drops his G's. He uses the word folks when he refers to people.
Yeah.
And it's, to be honest, it's kind of insulting. It really is. That it's like, you have to either be one of the people all the time or be like the smart guy who's in charge of everything all of the time, but don't like turn it on and off depending on who you're talking to, because that's condescending.
Yeah, that's showing the edges to the various masks that you're wearing. So when you're convincing it to one degree, it means that we can't trust any of the others, let alone the one that's in front of us currently.
Also, it just sounds like you folks might not understand what I'm saying unless I talk to you in this tone of voice.
Because you're dumb.
Yeah.
As stumps.
Yeah. Let's do our entertainment news.
I couldn't agree more. Yes, we shall.
Ooh. Do. Anyway. A couple featured on the first season of the MTV reality show 16 and Pregnant have lost their child to the state and face criminal charges after officers serving a search warrant found their home was filled with feces, flies, and maggots.
That's kind of like getting canceled from your family.
Joshua Rendon and Ebony Jackson Rendon, both now 19, were charged Tuesday after a search of their home at the Little Rock Air Force Base. They were living on the Air Force Base. The Arkansas Department of Human Services took custody of their 2-year-old child, who was born while the TV show was taping. Rendon is a member of the Air Force. They face felony charges of maintaining a drug premises and unauthorized use of another's property to facilitate a crime. They're also charged with misdemeanor child endangerment, possession of drug paraphernalia, and possession of a controlled substance. Jacksonville Police Captain Kenny Boyd said officers found 1 gram of synthetic marijuana.
We sell that at my store.
Yeah. Empty packaging and pipes allegedly used to smoke the synthetic marijuana. Boyd also said the home was in deplorable condition. Human and animal feces were on the floors.
Human
feces.
I couldn't tell which one's the dog or which one's mine.
I'm hoping that was from the kid. because otherwise, wow. On the floors and walls in each room, an animal control officer took away three dogs that were kept inside. The house was full of flies with collections of maggots in a number of areas.
Nice.
Yeah. Rendon's desire to join the Air Force was an element in the show 16 and Pregnant. He and Jackson Rendon lived in Colorado Springs, Colorado, which is home to the Air Force Academy. An MTV bio calls Jackson Rendon a military brat who lived with her mother but spent most of her time with Rendon, who was her fiancé at the time. Yeah.
See, I think there needs to be a rule in entertainment, and more specifically to the toddlers and Tierra's generation, where if you're effing, like, if you want to just screw up your life or show what a train wreck your life is, that's fine. I've got no issue with that. But when you're taking somebody that doesn't have the ability to defend themselves, that's abuse, and it needs to stop.
And here we have, we have done just that.
Sweet.
Yes. NBC and Dunder Mifflin have announced the new manager of the Scranton office of the Make-Believe Paper Company, portrayed in The Office. So if you have not watched last night's episode of The Office and you don't want it spoiled for you, don't listen to the rest of what I'm about to tell you. The reveal was made on Thursday's season premiere, completing a transition process that began with last season's departure by longtime series star Steve Carell. In July, NBC announced it had signed James Spader as a full-time cast member.
Blaine. They hired Blaine. That's not a name.
That's a home appliance.
That's a home appliance.
He reprises his guest role as manipulative Robert California, who over the summer was hired as the office's new regional manager. But quickly, in the eighth season premiere, he wangled a promotion to CEO of Sabre, the parent corporation of Dunder Mifflin, which left the manager's position vacant again, and it was filled by Andy Bernard, played by Ed Helms.
Nice.
Which I think is... that is appropriate, and that is good. I heartily approve.
I think that
I haven't seen it yet, but I'm just saying Ed Helms is awesome, and it's good that it went in house.
Yeah,
is what I'm saying.
The Daily Show with Jon Stewart needs to just be given some kind of award. Just create an award and give it to them because of just the careers that it is launching, like almost like fireworks. You know, Stephen Colbert, who I think has risen to, if not surpassed, The Daily Show. Steve Carell. Ed Helms. Pretty much, if you've ever worked as an anchor on that show, Dimitri Martin, who I love his show.
John Hodgman sat in, yeah.
Every person that has come in contact with that show, it's almost like you become a darling and therefore are like a license to print money.
Except for Olivia Munn, because she wasn't very good at it.
I liked Olivia Munn, though.
But now she's doing sitcoms, so it's not like we have to feel sorry for her.
No. And it's hard to feel sorry for a girl who's pretty and you know. But
and
she,
everyone loves her, and yes.
I don't know if it's just my weakness for pretty girls that talk nerd, but she strikes me as a kind of person that like that gets the work done. She just doesn't sit there and rely on the fact that she's cute. Like, she can make fun of herself and at the same time kind of use her gift of being pretty extensively pleasing, aesthetically pleasing, to her benefit, while at the same time getting done the work and the job that needs to be done. So,
well, and speaking of attractive actresses who and what the future may hold,
yeah.
Kim Delaney, star of the television show Army Wives, had to be escorted from the podium at an event in Philadelphia after struggling to read her speech from a teleprompter. It happened Thursday at an event honoring former Defense Secretary Robert Gates.
Oh, gee.
Delaney is a 52-year-old Philadelphia native and, again, star of the TV show Army Wives. Her remarks were punctuated by long pauses and fragmented sentences. After several minutes, a video began to play. She was escorted from the podium to a chair on the side of the stage by a woman who appeared to be a producer. Her publicist did not immediately respond to a message seeking comment. The event Thursday at the National Constitution Center was in honor of Gates, who received the 2011 Liberty Medal, which is a civic award. And if you go to AP, anywhere that they have the Associated Press things, you will find the photograph of Kim Delaney giving her speech. And...
just... looking kind of like, yeah.
So, Rob Gates. Yeah, she looks hammered. And granted, I'm sure they chose a photograph specifically. Here she is exiting the podium, giving somebody a drunken wink.
Are you at the after party?
Call me. Yeah, so that... That
we should have apple teenies.
Not her best moment. John Travolta visited the widow of mob boss John Gotti to do research for his upcoming movie role as the mafia kingpin. Hmm. The New York Post reports that Travolta arrived Thursday at the Gotti home in New York City to meet with widow Victoria Gotti, her son John Jr. Gotti, and other key players. The Post said the Pulp Fiction star was greeted with handshakes and hugs. He brought a gift bag for Victoria Gotti and stayed inside for more than 2 hours.
I wonder what was in that gift bag.
I want to know what's in that gift bag so bad. All he would say when he emerged was that he was doing research for a movie. John Gotti died in prison in 2002. The movie Gotti, In the Shadow of My Father, is set to start shooting in January.
Do you remember that that horrible, short-lived sitcom, Growing Up Gotti?
Yes. Oh, indeed.
I mean, if that was seriously like the mother hen that laid the rotten egg that was Jersey Shore. Like, if any self-respecting person that has come from New Jersey, and I know quite a few people that, much like when Americans go abroad, don't want to say where they're from because of the fear of just like the out-and-out hatred that they will have thrown upon them. Jersey has kind of ushered in that same era. They're like the America's America. Like, they're the part of the country that people are just like, nah, I'm from Baltimore. I'm a drug kingpin from Baltimore. There's no way I'm Jersey. What?
Jersey. One of my favorite hate mail letters that I got, hate things that I ever got when I was a film critic, actually, is it was an easy joke, a very easy joke, when I reviewed the movie Jersey Girl by Kevin Smith. And I did. I went for the low-hanging fruit, and I said something along the lines of, you know, the movie, like, stinks as bad as the state for which it is named. So, and that was my pull quote on Rotten Tomatoes. And so that ended up with, I got so much hate mail just from people going, you've never been to New Jersey. It's beautiful. It's beautiful there.
Well, and also,
how dare you?
People who have worked in that sort of...
It's the Garden State.
If you're in a porta potty long enough, the smell kind of becomes part of the background and you don't notice it anymore. Whereas somebody else walking into said porta potty for the first time are kind of greeted with this. I've lived on the East Coast. I have smelled New Jersey. And I'm sorry that your olfactory senses have now just sort of given up, much like majority of the people that live there as well.
I'm going to let's do another serious story.
Okay.
Shall we?
Yes.
Before the end of the show. So we can leave everyone with some, you know, something to think about.
Okay, a little food for thought.
Mahmoud Ahmadinejad delivered a rambling anti-Western tirade at the United Nations.
Cool dude.
Go figure. And the American and European diplomats in attendance walked out. What has become an increasingly common scene played out again Thursday at the UN General Assembly. It was the Iranian leader's seventh visit to New York, and while the usual widespread protest and controversy that has surrounded his past visits was noticeably more demure this time around, that didn't really change the scene inside the new UN. Ahmadinejad repeated many of his traditional attacks against the U.S. and the West, saying global poverty was a direct result of greed for materialism in the United States and Europe, suggesting that 9/11 may have been an American-led conspiracy, and calling the U.S. decision not to disclose the location of Osama bin Laden's burial mysterious. Ambassador Susan Rice says the U.S. finds Mahmoud Ahmadinejad's comments odious and says America is still quite concerned about Iran's nuclear interests. That's right.
The United States is gravely concerned about Iran's nuclear program and its ambitions to have what we believe is a nuclear weapon.
Ahmadinejad added, they threaten anyone who questions the Holocaust and September 11th with sanctions and military action? They said that. The U.S. condemned the address almost immediately. Mark Kornblau, a spokesman for the U.S. mission to the United Nations, told the New York Times, Mr. Ahmadinejad had a chance to address his own people's aspirations for freedom and dignity, but instead he again turned to abhorrent anti-Semitic slurs and despicable conspiracy theories. Susan Rice, the ambassador, said that as a host country, the U.S. can't prohibit Ahmadinejad from coming to the country to speak.
We find what Ahmadinejad does and says when he comes to the United Nations absolutely odious, hateful, anti-Semitic, unacceptable, which is why the United States for three consecutive years, including today, have led a walkout of his speech.
So, so that happened.
Yeah.
Rambling Ahmadinejad.
I found a video on YouTube that... kind of sums up 9/11.
Is it the baby monkey riding a pig?
Baby monkey.
I love that.
Baby monkey.
Riding on a pig,
maybe
monkey.
Oh yeah.
Nothing.
It's whistling, but no.
It's a metaphor.
It is.
Yeah.
It was just very well done and very well kind of sums up everything. And it's like one of those things where there's no fingers being pointed. We're just going to list all of the facts as they actually are, and you are free to walk away from it and and take whatever it is that you will from it. As the case may be.
No, wait, no. They actually laid out facts and
yes.
told you to make your own decision.
Yes.
That's not how we do things.
No, there was, I know. I'm like,
that's,
I kept.
That's un-American, Jim Willig.
I was left stock
Why
still.
Why do you hate Fox News in America?
Well, I don't hate them. I mean, if they were on fire, I would attempt to extinguish said
Why
fire.
Why do you hate our way of life?
You'll have to find
first,
out.
First, you came for my toddlers and tiaras.
And I said nothing. Then you spoke ill of the Jersey Shore. But you'll have to find out the answer to that coming up next hour when we will be rejoined with the Rick Emerson Show with your host, me, Big Jim Willig, and Don Taylor. But
Don Taylor.
And, well, most importantly, Don Taylor.
Thank you.
But Legion of News comes to you from the studios of the Emerson.
A pretty pony.
A pretty, pretty show pony. Comes to you from the studios of the Emerson News Network, high atop the Milkpacking District in the heart of beautiful Southeast Portland, Oregon. At the news desk, Don Taylor, advanced technology and magic provided by Sir Thomas Gill.
Huzzah!
Our executive producer is Bruce Agler and chief of staff is Cheryl Kenakoa. Join us next hour for more of the Rick Emerson Show. For the Legion of News, this is Big Jim saying thank you for listening. And please, stand by.
The Rick Emerson Show begins shortly. Keep listening. This is the Emerson News Network.